Director of Programming at Perimeter Institute, and it's my pleasure, as always, to welcome you to the Mike Lazaridis Theater of Ideas for another lecture as part of Einstein Fest, as we have just passed the halfway mark of the festival. Still lots more to come. And reminder, as always, if you haven't picked up a program booklet, you can get one out in the atrium to find out what happens between now and October 23rd. As I said, still much to come. We hustled a few people out of our exhibition tonight, just for your information. The exhibitions are always open in the evening from 5 o'clock until 9 o'clock. So following the lecture, the exhibitions still are open until about 9 o'clock. And the Black Hole Bistro, always open before lectures for dinner and also open post-lecture for drinks and food. So please join us on the fourth floor of the Black Hole Bistro, which you find by taking the elevator on this side or the staircase to the fourth floor on that side. And tonight, we're very pleased to welcome David Rowe as our guest lecturer. David Rowe studied mathematics and history of science at the University of Oklahoma and took a second doctorate in history at the Graduate Center of the City University, New York. He served as book review editor, managing editor, and editor of the journal Historia Mathematica. In 1992, David Rowe was appointed professor of history of mathematics and natural sciences at Johannes Gutenberg University in Mainz, where he presently teaches. His research has mainly focused on mathematics in Germany, but in recent years he has been concerned with Einstein's general theory of relativity and the broader cultural and political impact of Einstein's ideas. As part of this effort, he and Robert Schulman, who incidentally will be lecturing this weekend at Einstein Fest along with David Rowe, have co-edited a source book entitled The Political Einstein, Private Thoughts and Public Passions, scheduled for publication by Princeton University Press in 2006. We are very pleased to have him with us tonight. Please welcome David Rowe.
Thanks so much, Michael. It is indeed a great pleasure to be here, and something, I guess, that I had imagined that I would be speaking three times here at Perimeter Institute about Einstein and different aspects of his work. Some of you may have done your homework and looked at the synopses of talks and so forth, and that you'll notice perhaps right away that my talk doesn't have the same title as appears in the announcement. So what you're going to get here is, in fact, a somewhat different take on this theme of geometry and physical space. But I'm open to questions about the topic I won't be talking about so directly afterward. But I'll be mainly talking around that here this evening. So for those of you familiar with modern geometry, even if only superficially, let me begin by saying that it takes a good deal of historical imagination to picture the issues I'll be talking about here. The difficulty stems mainly from our tendency to think of geometry as a branch of pure mathematics, rather than as a science with deep empirical roots, the oldest natural science, so to speak. For many of us, there's a natural tendency to think of geometry in idealized Platonic terms. So to gain a sense of how 19th century authorities debated over the true geometry of physical space, it may help to remember the etymological roots of the word geometry. Geo plus metria literally means to measure the earth, of course. And in fact, the Greek historian Herodotus reported this was in fact originally an Egyptian science. Each spring, the Egyptians were forced to remeasure the land after the Nile River flooded, altering its banks and creating the problem of determining property lines. And among those who were engaged in this land surveying were the legendary Egyptian rope stretchers, the Harpidanoptai, who were occasionally depicted in artwork relating to Egyptian ceremonials. Well, today we are apt to smile when reading Herodotus' remarks, dismissing these as just, in fact, another example of the Greek tendency to think of ancient Egypt as the fount of all wisdom. Herodotus was in fact famous for repeating such lore, and he was apparently confusing geometry with the science of geodesy, when the latter has, in fact, little to do with the former. Well, at least not anymore. We don't think of circles, triangles, or the five Platonic solids as real figures. They are far too perfect, the product of the mind's eye. Of course, there's still plenty of room for disagreement among moderns. A formalist will stress that geometrical figures are mere conventions, or at best, images we attach to fictive objects that have no purpose other than to illustrate a system of ideas ultimately grounded in undefined terms and arbitrary axioms. A modern-day Platonist would vehemently object to this characterization, which puts all too much emphasis on purely arbitrary constructions rather than conceiving of geometrical figures as idealized instantiations of perfect forms. Well, for those of you who might like to see what such a debate looked like around 1900, I could recommend the correspondence between the philosopher Gottlob Frege and the mathematician David Hilbert. Their dispute began when Frege wrote to Hilbert after reading the opening pages of Hilbert's Foundations of Geometry, the very book that helped make the modern axiomatic approach so fashionable. Although one of the founding fathers of modern logic, Frege simply could not accept Hilbert's notion that the fundamental concepts of geometry had no intrinsic meaning. Points, lines, and planes were not simply empty words for Frege. They were in some deep sense real, and geometry was the body of knowledge which uncovered the properties of real figures. Hilbert's claim that at bottom all that matters was the consistency of a certain set of axioms was anathema in Frege's eyes. Well, most mathematicians, to the extent that they grasped what was at stake here, sided with Hilbert in this debate. And over the course of the next three decades, the status of the continuum nevertheless played a major role in the larger foundations debates between formalists and intuitionists. Those rather esoteric discussions, however, left traditional realist assumptions about the nature of geometrical knowledge behind. For despite their strong differences, the proponents of formalism and intuitionism were both guided by their respective visions of pure mathematics, independent of its relevance to other disciplines like astronomy and physics. So this little run-up is just to emphasize one fundamental point, and that is that a huge shift takes place around 1900 regarding the status of geometrical knowledge. This reorientation was certainly profound, but it seems to have been rather quickly forgotten in the wake of other, even more dramatic developments, because soon afterward, Einstein's general theory of relativity would lead to a flurry of new discussions about the interplay between space, time, and matter. Leading mathematicians like Hilbert and also his student Hermann Weyl, they became both strong proponents of Einstein's ideas, while at the same time disagreeing rather profoundly about these epistemological issues relating to the mathematical continuum, a concept of central importance for the geometer. So looking backwards from the 1920s, it would seem that the opposing views of formalists and intuitionists actually reflect distinctly modern attitudes about the nature of geometrical knowledge that would have been scarcely thinkable prior to 1900. Up until then, geometry was always conceived as somehow wedded to a physical world that displayed discernible geometrical features. Take the developments that led to the birth of modern science in the 17th century. Anyone who studies the works of Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo, or Newton cannot help but notice the deep impact of geometry on their conceptions of the natural world. But the same can be said of Carl Friedrich Gauss, whose career ought to make us rethink what Herodotus wrote about the Egyptian roots of the science of geometry. Well, Gauss, as you may know, was practically the first figure in a chain of eminent German mathematicians and astronomers in Göttingen. He was both a mathematician and an astronomer. But what I'd like to also emphasize is that beyond that, he was a professional surveyor who at least occasionally waded through the marshy hinterlands of Hanover, taking sightings in order to construct a net of triangles that would span this largely uncharted region. And this could be tiring at times. He's, of course, revered in Germany, but forgotten now that the economy has taken a turn for the worse. And this is where he worked originally, the old Sternwarte, or Astronomical Observatory, in Göttingen, no longer can be seen. After a few years, this building was erected in its place, and we could take a peek, if we like, into his workshop and wonder about what Gauss was thinking about. Well, geometry, geodesy, these things were not so separated at the time for him, obviously. And what's quite interesting is that his work on geodesy inspired a profound contribution to pure geometry, Gauss's study of the intrinsic geometry of surfaces. And this helped, this new theory helped launch a theory of measurement in geometry that opened the way to probing the geometry of space itself. Well, only a half century earlier, two leading French mathematicians, Clairaut and Maupertuis, had studied the shape of the Earth's surface, showing that it formed an oblate spheroid. And that meant that as one moved northward on the surface of the Earth, one discovered that the Earth flattened, in effect, the curvature of the Earth flattened. Here you see, in fact, Maupertuis pictured here, is the work, La Figure de la Terre, next to him, and you see his hand flattening the Earth. He gained a great reputation, in fact, for this accomplishment. Well, it was, in fact, the decisive test for the Newtonian theory of gravitation, which at that time was not, of course, adhered to by everyone in France. And so this turned out to be the key test that enabled the Newtonians to overcome the last bastion of opposition that the Cartesians had put up in France. So even before Gauss, of course, you can find examples where precise measurements of the Earth's curvature had already exerted a deep impact on modern science. But the mathematics of this that Gauss develops out of this is, of course, the new and novel thing, and it's terribly important for Einstein's work. In the 1820s, Gauss took the measurement of the Earth as his point of departure for an abstract theory of surfaces. And this work is rightly regarded as marking the birth of modern differential geometry. Gauss asked whether and how a scientist could determine the curvature of an arbitrary surface by means of measurements made only along the surface itself, that is, without knowing anything at all about the way in which the surface might be embedded in space. Here are two examples of surfaces, at the one on the top and the one on the bottom, of negative and positive curvature, respectively. These concepts are not new with Gauss. They go back to Euler. But Gauss comes up with this intrinsic interpretation. So in one sense, he's following a development that's an 18th century theory of Euler. And in that theory, there are two principal curvatures associated with a point on a surface. Here, if we take the top case here, you can see the point C has two directions where the curvature is here smallest and greatest, but they're in opposite directions, which is characteristic of a point where the curvature on the surface is negative. Here you see down below the opposite sort of thing. And here you have a piece of a torus where the curvature is variable. So it's negative on the inside, positive here on the outside, and then there's a sort of point in between. You can imagine the point B being either on top or bottom of the torus, and the tangent plane there would in fact be tangent along a whole circle. So the curvature becomes zero at that point. These things, though, are not new with Gauss. They were known to Euler. And in his theory, there are two principal directions associated with each point of a surface. These are obtained by taking the surface normal at each point as the axis for a pencil of planes. And Euler proved that by rotating these planes about this axis, there will be two particular ones that cut the surface in curves with a maximum and minimum plane curvature at the given point. And beyond that, these two special planes will always be perpendicular to one another. So they determine the so-called two principal directions with plane curvatures, kappa 1 and kappa 2. These, however, kappa 1 and kappa 2, are not intrinsic invariants of the surface since they depend on knowing how it sits in the surrounding space. But remarkably, the product of the two, kappa 1 times kappa 2, turns out to be an intrinsic invariant. And this is what Gauss proves in this famous theorem, Theorema Egregium. If two surfaces are isometric, then they have the same Gaussian curvature, kappa 1 times kappa 2, at corresponding points. Well, cartographers had, of course, long realized that it was impossible to find an isometric mapping that projected a sphere, a surface of constant positive curvature, onto a plane. Thus, something had to be sacrificed in representing the surface of the Earth on a flat map, either by distorting the distances between points or the angles between the curves. On a sphere, the surface normal at each point passes through the sphere's center, and each plane section determines a great circle. So the product of kappa 1 and kappa 2 here, the Gaussian curvature, is simply going to be the product of the inverse values of the radii, 1 over r squared. And this is an intrinsic invariant. That's the breakthrough here for Gauss, which means, of course, that two spheres would have the same geometry if and only if their radii agree. All right, this is all classical, and you might think it's very, very far from Einstein, so I'm going to now make a big jump here, and I'm going to cite from a famous lecture of Einstein's in Kyoto in 1923 during his trip to Japan. He recalled how he found the key ideas to his theory of gravitation. But you'll notice I've prefaced it here in bold with some lectures by an obscure geometer by the name of Karl Geiser, who lectured on surface theory in Zurich at the ETH in Zurich. That's, of course, where Einstein studied. So let's see how these things, what they have to do with one another. First, I quote the most famous passage from this lecture of Einstein. "I was sitting in a chair in the patent office in Bern when all of a sudden I was struck by a thought. If a person falls freely, he will certainly not feel his own weight. I was startled. This simple thought made a really deep impression on me. My excitement motivated me to develop a new theory of gravitation. My next thought was, when a person falls, he is accelerating. His observations are nothing but observations in an accelerated system." And of course, he's relating here the ideas behind the so-called equivalence principle and so forth, the founding idea for the link between special and general relativity. But then in the lecture, he jumps ahead to another passage, and this is the one that interests us right now. This remained an unsolved problem for me until 1912. In that year, I suddenly realized that there was good reason to believe that the Gaussian theory of services might be the key to unlock the mystery. I realized at that point the great importance of Gaussian surface coordinates. However, I was still unaware of the fact that Riemann had given an even more profound discussion of the foundations of geometry. We'll get to Riemann in the end. We're going to stick with Gauss here. I happened to remember that Gauss's theory had been covered in a course I had taken during my student days with a professor of mathematics named Geiser. From this, I developed my ideas, and I arrived at the notion that geometry must have physical significance. It's a quite famous passage, too, except nobody talks too much about this guy Geiser. So let's make a few links here. Einstein and mathematicians from Zurich and Göttingen. I want to throw in Göttingen because they're all so linked anyway, and there's one single photo that brings six of them together from 1917. That's Hilbert here in the middle. This is Marcel Grossmann, the collaborator and friend of Einstein. There's Karl Geiser, professor of geometry. Hermann Weyl, his wife. That's Konstantin Karatiadori, with whom Einstein corresponded about all kinds of interesting things. And way in the back there, that's Paul Bernays, who was Hilbert's assistant, but he also wrote about special relativity theory and gave Grossmann and Einstein several ideas when they were first working on the theory of gravitation. All kinds of links in one photo. But I want to stick with Geiser here a moment and these Gaussian surface ideas that Einstein alluded to. So what did he mean when he talked about that? What was that insight back in 1912? Well, there's an analogy between the gravitational problem as he was dealing with it at the time. Remember, he's trying to use geometry somehow in order to capture inertial properties of moving bodies, falling bodies or whatever, accelerating bodies. And so he sees a link there, and the link is this theorem, which says that the force-free motion of a point mass along a surface takes place along geodesic curves. So a surface like a sphere, the geodesic curves are great circles, and differential geometry is largely about studying these paths called geodesics. Well, Einstein remembered pretty well. He attended the lecture, though we know he doesn't like to attend lectures so much, but Grossmann attended very diligently and took notes. And so, in fact, we find this theorem in the lecture course of Geiser in Grossmann's notes, but the really significant clincher here is it's one of the very first things in the Zurich notebook that Einstein, when he begins with Grossmann to collaborate on a theory of gravitation, he writes that result down. So this is like a guiding result. We can maybe picture it here with this example, which Einstein very well must have known of, could have thought of in this context. These geodesics, in the case of an ellipsoid, are given by these curves which cut one another orthogonally. So the lines of curvature by a famous theorem of Dupin turn out to be just the results you get by taking systems of so-called confocal surfaces which cut one another along curves like this. So what you're seeing there looping around these focal points and so forth are various geodesics, and you can see how they cut one another. Well, the curvature lines by Euler's theorems. You don't need Gaussian surface theory. All you need is Euler's surface theory here. The curvature lines are here determining the geodesics. So this is the type of stuff that he writes about very directly, and now we have proof in historical sources that more or less nail down that there was something really to that remark. Now, I want to jump way back here and talk about these ideas some more, much more generally. This is the first link to Einstein. Let's talk about curvature as an intrinsic property. Well, we mentioned that already, but this raises more general questions about the nature of measurement in geometry historically. So let's start from the beginning, the Pythagorean theorem, a ubiquitous result familiar to many cultures and already found by Babylonian mathematicians more than a millennium before the time of Pythagoras. It tells us something fundamental about planar measurements in right angles, in right triangles. The square of the hypotenuse equals the sum of the squares on the two sides. Well, some have actually conjectured that the Egyptian rope stretchers, whom Democritus once praised, used the converse of the Pythagorean theorem to lay out right angles at the corners of temples and pyramids. The claimant suggests that these professional surveyors used a rope with 12 knots of equal length. By pulling the rope taut, they could form a 3-4-5 right triangle. A very nice idea, but I'm afraid it's only an idea. We have no evidence to support that claim. Archaeologists can still, of course, measure the angles of Egyptian buildings, but our access to the mathematical knowledge that lay behind the architectural splendors of ancient Egypt is highly limited. Papyri can easily disintegrate with time, and only two papyri have been found that provide much insight into the mathematical methods of the time. The Rhine papyrus, which does show triangles occasionally, and the Moscow papyrus, but nothing like the Pythagorean theorem is found in any of these sources. Historians of Mesopotamian mathematics have been luckier. They have had plenty of source material available ever since it became possible to decipher the cuneiform tablets archaeologists began turning up a little more than a century ago. These tablets were prepared by using a wedge-shaped instrument to gouge out marks on a clay tablet that was then baked in an oven, hence the preservation of these things. A number of them contain sophisticated mathematics written in the familiar base 60 number system that Greek astronomers like Ptolemy eventually adopted for angle measurements. Some of the Babylonian mathematical texts reveal not just a passing familiarity with the Pythagorean theorem, but even a masterful use of it for numerical computations, like approximating the value of the square root of 2 or calculating Pythagorean triples. But it's the Greeks, of course, who are credited with proving these results and setting up a science of pure geometry. This is in fact, just sketches how Euclid presents the proof of the Pythagorean theorem using congruent triangles in a rather nifty way. So it's the Greeks who we credit, of course, with developing a science of geometry as such. And we're accustomed to thinking of the Pythagorean theorem as the centerpiece of a special type of geometry, the classical Euclidean model. We talk about various models for all kinds of geometries and spaces today, but probably few people sense that this is a distinctly modern way of thinking. Classically, geometry was always about figures in space, whereas space itself was never the object of study. One didn't go about thinking of different kinds of spaces or even space in the plural. True, in the 19th century, mathematicians studied different kinds of properties of figures in space. They differentiated between the metrical and projective properties of curves and surfaces, and they used calculus to study their differential properties. By mid-century, they'd even begin to leap by analogy into higher dimensions. And above all, they like to use complex numbers in connection with a mathematical realm of four dimensions. But to the extent, in the 19th century, to the extent that mathematicians identified themselves as geometers, they drew their inspiration from phenomena they could somehow visualize or imagine in ordinary Euclidean space. In the German tradition, one spoke of anschauliche Geometrie, a term that doesn't really translate well into English. The popular textbook with this title by Hilbert and Cohn-Fossen, was published in the United States as Mathematics and the Imagination. And it would be exaggerated to call this a picture book approach to geometry, but without the visuals, the book would certainly lose all its charm. Throughout much of Western history, the discipline of geometry was treated as closely linked with logic. But many experts appreciated that the source of geometrical knowledge owed nothing to logical rigor. The Hilbert and Cohn-Fossen text makes this abundantly clear. It seldom even presents a chain of arguments. The authors mainly just describe and explain what the reader is supposed to see, a figure like that, and others. This kind of seeing, though, requires imagination. And to be imagined, a figure or configuration must have some relation to objects in real space. And that takes us back to Euclid again. Euclidean geometry, in its original garb, was traditionally regarded not as one model among many for geometry, but rather as the model for a rigorous scientific system based on deductive argument. The English universities, above all Oxford and Cambridge, cultivated this tradition for centuries. Even in the 1880s, Charles Dodson, better known today as Lewis Carroll, was a valiant spokesman for this conservative approach to teaching geometry. I have to throw him in here. The three girls who were daughters of a dean he knew, the one named Alice you know from this little work of Charles Dodson. Like so many Victorian intellectuals, Dodson primarily valued geometry as a discipline for training the mind to think logically. The tightly constructed arguments in the first two books of Euclid's Elements left an indelible impression on the logician Lewis Carroll. In Euclid and his modern rivals, one of the oddest dramatic works ever written, and surely never performed, Carroll brought Euclid's ghosts back to life to face his challengers. This play, without a plot, quickly turns into a bizarre mathematical dialogue in which Euclid defends his text and leaves it to the judges in Hades to decide whether any of the 13 rival modernized treatments of plane geometry deserve to take its place. The showdown that ensues has all parties citing the elements, chapter and verse, scurrying to discover which textbook most effectively honed the minds of young Englishmen. Now, just to be sure that you have the right picture here, the authors whose books came under discussion are all respectable English gentlemen, among the leading mathematicians of their day. So these rival texts obviously did not breathe a word about the newfangled non-Euclidean geometries that had since found their way across the channel from the continent. Such monstrosities clearly had no place in the college curriculum. Euclid's rivals merely sought to upgrade the very same body of knowledge one found in the Elements. Needless to say, the author of Alice in Wonderland gave Euclid's ghost full satisfaction, routing the 13 rivals with scholarly acumen and witty jibes. Nor should we be surprised that the meatiest arguments on both sides were reserved for Euclid's controversial fifth postulate concerning parallel lines. Historically, mathematicians have long focused attention on this parallel postulate as the crux of what made Euclid's presentation of geometry Euclidean. Even in antiquity, many were dissatisfied with this very feature of the Elements. Some of Euclid's modern rivals preferred Playfair's more elegant formulation, but Lewis Carroll clearly disagreed with them. So the Playfair formulation is the one you're probably familiar with, where you're given a line and a point not on it, and Playfair says there can be at most one line through C parallel to the given line. The Euclidean version has nothing whatsoever to do with lines that extend to infinity. In fact, all constructions in Euclidean geometry take place in a finite region. So lines for Euclid to begin with are for us line segments. And if two line segments are met by a third with the sum of the two interior angles on one side, this one here, are less than two right angles, we can construct extensions of the two lines which will eventually meet. This is a very prolix formulation of the parallel postulate that Euclid needed, and it, which is defended by Lewis Carroll. Well, it's, I think, not, it's worth a moment of our time to just contemplate what's behind that. So Carroll disagrees with all of those who think that Playfair's formulation, although maybe more elegant, is superior. And I think his arguments are both sound and convincing. Playfair's version of the parallel postulate is in the spirit of an existence theorem in modern mathematics. It lacks the constructive character that makes Euclid's rendition so useful. In Greek geometry, the emphasis was always on constructibility. Though Euclid also proves theorems, which are systematically distinguished, however, from propositions which are called constructions. Euclid's fifth postulate enables the geometer to know in advance not merely that two lines, when extended, will intersect, but also where the point of intersection will occur, namely on the side where the angle sum is smaller than two right angles. And in fact, if you look at Euclid carefully, he makes crucial use of this property in a parabolic application of area, one of the central theorems in Book One. So Carroll, Lewis Carroll, clearly understood the distinction between theorems and problems in geometry. And this cuts into one of the deepest themes in the history of mathematics. It's the issue of existence in mathematics. Do things exist by virtue of proofs in which one proves, for example, that the non-existence leads to a contradiction? Well, that would be Hilbert, of course. The intuitionists say, no, you have to construct your mathematical objects. So this is all, in fact, very cuts very much into those modern issues. So Carroll not only understood this distinction between theorems and problems in geometry, he even has Euclid's ghost address the proposal by the British Committee for the Improvement of Geometrical Teaching that called for presenting theorems and problems separately. And Euclid's able to, of course, knock that argument down very easily. Of course, a more serious objection to all of this came from those mathematicians who maintained that Euclid's fifth postulate was not a postulate at all, but rather a theorem of plane geometry. And if you know anything about the history of non-Euclidean geometry, then you already know that, of course, this was a centuries-long effort that, in fact, just turned up more and more connections between the parallel postulate and other parts of mathematics. The Pythagorean theorem turns out to be equivalent to the parallel postulate. The theorem that the sum of the angles in a triangle is 180 degrees is equivalent. And so for us, thinking more axiomatically, it is a simple matter to replace the angle sum in a triangle with some other sum, for example, that it exceeds 180 degrees. This is easily enough done. And that being the case, it's worth asking, why weren't the Greeks willing to entertain this possibility? Well, clearly the Greeks were familiar with this case. This is just spherical geometry, of course. And we can read textbooks, in ancient textbooks, on so-called spherics, what was known as spherical geometry. The shortest distance between two points on the surface of a sphere forms the arc of a great circle, a plane section of the sphere where the plane passes through the sphere's center. Taking such geodesics as the counterparts to straight lines in a plane, it's easy to see that the sum of the angles in a spherical triangle exceeds 180 degrees. And in fact, this angle sum varies. The smaller the triangle, the smaller will be the sum of its angles, a result that was elegantly proved by Euler in the 18th century. But now this leads us to ask again, if the Greeks already knew several fundamental results of spherical geometry, why did it take so long before mathematicians were willing to accept the validity of non-Euclidean geometries? Wasn't the geometry on the surface of a sphere already a counterexample that refuted the absolute validity of Euclid's theory of parallels? Well, apparently not. In fact, the answer to this puzzle deserves serious scrutiny, as it will tell us a good deal about the status of geometrical investigations, not only in antiquity, but for many centuries afterward. If we widen the scope of our inquiry into the ancient sciences, then we'll see that spherics was for many centuries studied as a foundation for astronomy and astrology. In fact, the Spherica of Autolycus, the oldest extant mathematical text that's available in its entirety, was inspired by a geometrical analysis of the risings and settings of the sun and stars throughout the year. You see diagrams in his book that these are, of course, modern ones, but his look very similar to this sort of thing. A more poetic account of the geometry of the heavens can be found near the beginning of Plato's Timaeus, where he describes how the cosmos was constructed by the demiurge using two great circles, the celestial equator and the ecliptic. In the ancient world, the motions of heavenly bodies were circular, unlike the natural motions of terrestrial objects, which rise or fall as they seek their natural place in the world. Physical objects, as we know them here on Earth, move about in the space surrounding us. Plane and solid geometry studied the properties of figures in this terrestrial realm. Whether or not the roots of this science were Egyptian, they surely drew on centuries of human experience with physical objects in space. To fill up parts of space, builders used bricks of a uniform size and shape, rectangular solids, not round ones or solids with curved surfaces. Straightness and flatness were the primary spatial qualities one imagined in everyday life. A solid, such as a sphere, was obviously in some basic sense a more complex object than a solid figure bounded by plane figures. Both are treated in the last three books of Euclid's Elements, but it's clear that the latter figures, particularly the five Platonic solids, were regarded as fundamental. Some of these regular solids occur in nature in crystalline forms, and Plato identified four of them as the shapes of the four primary elements: earth, water, air, and fire. It wasn't, of course, a tradition that died with Plato. These are pictures from Kepler and so forth with the same four elements. The dodecahedron is reserved for a model of the cosmos itself. And so there's a long-standing sort of tradition with these sorts of figures as well. But the sphere, there's where the contrast here is. I think the sphere had a deep cosmic significance. The planets and fixed stars were conceived as carried about on giant invisible spheres. The natural rotational motion of spheres could be simulated here on Earth, of course, but the truly natural motions of terrestrial objects were rectilinear, straight up and down. Of course, the Earth itself was not seen as flat, but it was mainly on a cosmic scale that the sphere came forcefully into play in Greek science. And of course, Aristotle picks up on these distinctions and so forth, so this gets a long and solid tradition at the time of Euclid. Euclid lives right after Aristotle. Well, what about geometry? Spherics then are related to astronomy. Geometry has its closest ties to ancient mechanics, which was not a branch of natural science at all, but rather was synonymous with ancient technology. Mechanicians constructed machines just as geometers constructed figures and diagrams. Among the Greeks, Archimedes was a virtuoso in both disciplines. Indeed, his work successfully bridged the gap between mechanics and geometry, as he relied heavily on the law of the lever to weigh geometrical figures before proving theorems about their areas and volumes. That was one more Kepler thing I neglected to show you, the most famous application of the Platonic solids to cosmology, but moving on to the law of the lever, of course, he proves the law of the lever. This is this ingenious sort of argument where which works for rational distances. He's a very strict mathematician, so he's got cases, the rational case and irrational case, but you can see here everything's in balance. And if you move two of these things over left and right, then you get this configuration. If you do it another time, then you get this version where the lengths are in inverse proportion to the, they're in inverse proportion to the weights. And of course, this became legendary with Archimedes, what he did with this principle, which he uses all over the place. It has some neat little applications to hydrostatics, too, that I'll just throw in here, and his work on floating bodies, this critical question about what is the, for the stability of a figure, what is the angle, the maximal angle that you can tip this. This is a parabola, actually, but it's an idealized figure. So if you like, this is an early example of what gets to be called physical mathematics, mathematics inspired by physics. He asks and calculates then the maximal angle here. And of course, this is he lives in the island he lives in the city-state of Syracuse, where shipping is, of course, important. So these types of questions actually could be relevant to the world he lived in. And they were indeed relevant later on. The famous example of it's the maiden voyage of Gustav Adolf's flagship, the Vasa, which tipped over in Stockholm Harbor. And it was hauled up then only decades ago and sits in a museum now. But you can sense that maybe the center of gravity on that might be a little bit high. And so these have real-world applications, these ideas. Well, I've been talking here a lot about ancient things, but that's in order to make a connection, which I hope you'll appreciate, and that is to more modern things. As everyone familiar with the history of science knows, Isaac Newton was celebrated for demonstrating that the whole universe operates like a giant machine. For Newton effectively created the discipline of celestial mechanics when he published his Principia in 1687. Since he lived another 40 years, Newton also had ample time to comment. He had ample time to comment on his legendary success, and his assessments have been repeated countless times. One is tempted to discount his famous refrain that he stood on the shoulders of giants. On most occasions, Newton wasn't prone to such modesty. But perhaps we can make sense of this pronouncement by asking just whose shoulders he might have had in mind. To gain a better idea of what he thought he had accomplished, one might start by reading his preface to the Principia, one of many places where Newton writes about the relationship between geometry and mechanics. Quote, "The description of right lines and circles upon which geometry is founded belongs to mechanics. Geometry does not teach us to draw these lines, but requires them to be drawn." Newton went on to mention, at least briefly, the conceptions of mechanics set forth by Pappus of Alexandria. And so he's citing classic figures over and over again, and this reverence practically for antiquity is a very strong element. So he was, of course, ahead of his time in many respects. And it's easy to overlook then how steeped Newton was in the past. Unlike Descartes, he revered Euclid and the ancients, and this surely accounts for the arcane geometric style of the Principia. Not that he was merely paying homage to the ancients or trying to accommodate modern readers, as some historians of physics have suggested. Since most physicists, of course, learn celestial mechanics based on the analytic methods first developed by Euler and D'Alembert and others, they have a hard time squaring what they find in the Principia with their image of Newton as co-founder of the calculus. Thus, some have occasionally argued that Isaac Newton must have originally derived the results in the Principia by using the calculus. He then supposedly chose to couch the whole treatise in the language of traditional geometry in order not to overwhelm readers with mathematical terminology and techniques that were new and unfamiliar. While there seems not to be a scintilla of evidence to support this claim, and I don't know of any leading Newton scholar who thinks that Newton just dressed up the Principia in geometry to make it easier to swallow, and if he had done so, we'd have to conclude that he failed pretty miserably, since his contemporaries found it a very tough read, too. What we do find in Newton's published and unpublished writings are numerous explicit statements and arguments expressing why he preferred to use geometry as the natural mathematical language for treating problems in mechanics, including celestial mechanics. And by geometry, he meant traditional synthetic geometry in the tradition of Euclid and the Greeks. Newton believed that space had an absolute reality that endowed it with physical properties and geometrical structure. He accounted for inertial effects like the centrifugal forces that accompany rotations as due to the effort required to move against the grain of space, so to speak. His first law, describing the nature of force-free motion, tells us what it means to move with the grain of absolute space, namely in a straight line with uniform speed. Leibniz and others objected vociferously to Newton's quasi-theological doctrines regarding absolute space and time. But toward the end of the 18th century, Immanuel Kant gave them a central place in his epistemology. Kant's critique of pure reason was widely regarded as a tour de force that tamed the excesses of continental rationalism and metaphysics while overcoming the skepticism of Humean empiricism. Newtonian space and time provided Kant with the keys that led to a new synthesis. He argued that our knowledge of space and time had an utterly different character than all other forms of knowing. This knowledge was neither analytic nor a posteriori, meaning that we cannot know the properties of space and time by means of deductive reasoning nor by appealing to sense experience. Nevertheless, we can formulate true synthetic a priori propositions about space and time because they provide the foundations for all other forms of knowledge. Thus, according to Kant, space and time are the necessary preconditions for knowing. They supply the transcendent categories that give mankind the ability to know. So this is, of course, pretty heady stuff, Immanuel Kant, and I've never gotten very far trying to read it myself, I must say. You get a dizzy feeling, I think. But it had profound impact on the way people thought about these things in the 19th century. So now, in the little bit of remaining time, I want to just jump ahead to Gauss once again. So Gauss was famously, and I'll have to pass here over Galileo and come to Gauss and non-Euclidean geometry, because he's famously, of course, connected with non-Euclidean geometry. This is one of the statements he made in a letter. All of these are private communications. The assumption that the sum of the three angles of a triangle is less than 180 degrees leads to a curious geometry, quite different from ours, Euclidean geometry, but thoroughly consistent, which I've developed to my entire satisfaction, so that I can solve every problem in it, excepting the determination of a constant which cannot be fixed a priori. Of course, that's the curvature, in effect, that one can vary. The three angles of a triangle become as small as one wishes if only the sides are taken large enough, yet the area of the triangle can never exceed or even attain a certain limit, regardless of how great the sides are. Well, soon after his death in 1855, a friend wrote, one of Gauss's friends, that he'd actually attempted to test the hypothesis that space might be curved by measuring the angles in a large triangle that he used in his survey of Hanover. This is a controversial thesis because the evidence for it is not much more than, well, these sorts of statements, and it's rather indirect. But the possibility that space might be non-Euclidean is definitely something Gauss realized and communicated in private, but never ever talked about publicly. nearly, so he dies in 1855. He's nearly unapproachable during his lifetime. He passed from the scene without so much as once publicly addressing the dogma that the geometry of space had to be Euclidean. And so this was a huge opportunity because he knew about it, and of course, he wasn't the only one. These two founding figures of non-Euclidean geometry, Nicholas Lobachevsky and Janosz Bolyai, had worked out theories. Gauss was aware of this work, of course, and commended them in private, or indirectly at least, but he never ever publicly spoke out about it. So what you have here is a very curious thing, that this revolutionary theory in the history of mathematics, which is discovered already in the 1820s, the most prominent mathematician of the day believes that this is a real theory and has worked on it for decades, and yet it dies out. In 1860, no one is even aware of it, pretty much. And so it's a bunch of circumstances that lead mathematicians back into this fold, of course. And the last opportunity Gauss had to really promote this theory was, and now I come to Riemann here briefly, shortly before his death, he has one last chance to make his views about the geometry of space known. And that is when Bernhard Riemann delivers this famous Habilitationsvortrag, or lecture, is a postdoctoral, after submitting his postdoctoral thesis, this famous lecture on the hypotheses underlying geometry. And Gauss was the one who insisted that he speak on this theme. He actually had three different themes, and he wasn't even prepared to talk about this one. But Gauss was very insistent, no, you prepare this and talk about it. And then afterward, he apparently commented as follows. Gauss said, it surpassed all his expectations. In the greatest astonishment, on the way back from the faculty meeting, he spoke to Wilhelm Weber about the depth of the ideas presented by Riemann, expressing the greatest appreciation and an excitement rare for him. And then he dies. And he never encourages, or he and Weber and none of them encourage Riemann to publish this work. You'll see it's published in 1868, but notice the death date of Riemann. It's a posthumous publication. And so here's another decade goes by when brilliant ideas that are sitting there in the waiting just pretty much die out. So the beginning of the story is really in the mid-1860s, and then with the publication of Riemann's work, which has all kinds of stuff in it. One of the people who gets excited by it is Felix Klein, who's in Göttingen at this time. And what he writes about it, I think, tells a lot about how people receive this work when it, I mean, they're stunned. I still have a vivid recollection of the extraordinary impression that Riemann's ideas then made on the young mathematicians. Much appeared to us as dark and difficult, and yet of unfathomable depth. So now let me make the last connection here to Einstein in the last minute here. Of course, the Riemann-Einstein connection is long been known in some sense, but I think it's nice to fill in a few details. Who read this lecture when it came out? Klein, for one, Felix Klein, who was very young at that point. A mature mathematician, Christoffel. The Christoffel symbols, of course, come right out of this work that he publishes in 1869. Well, what do you know? Einstein had already read it back in 1902. It was one of the works in his little Olympia Academy, but probably very difficult to swallow for a physicist and so forth, so he didn't comment upon it much later. But the Italian mathematician Gregorio Ricci read it, and he developed the so-called Ricci calculus. And that work, although it wasn't acknowledged, you can see it was twice passed over by the Accademia dei Lincei when he submitted it, it did attract an important student, and that's Tullio Levi-Civita. So the two of them, at Felix Klein's request, publish in Matamasha et al. In this famous paper of 1901. And who read that paper? Well, Mozart Grossmann. Mozart Grossmann knew about that paper. And so when Einstein comes to him, desperate for some kind of mathematics to figure out this new theory he's developed, Grossmann immediately thinks of this theory, he knows about it, and so forth. The final thing here is this legendary remark, I suppose, Grossmann, du musst mir helfen, sonst werde ich verrückt. Grossmann, you've got to help me, otherwise I'll go crazy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. We have time for some questions. If you have a question, please raise your hand and one of the ushers will bring you a microphone. Any takers? Also, it takes a little while for the first person to ask a question. There's a question up here.
Could Einstein have figured out his theory without the math?
Well, then we should be a little more specific which part of the theory. So the special relativity or the gravitation? The general theory with the gravitational theory. Well, I guess the answer is probably no. I mean, I'm a historian of mathematics, and certainly part of my excitement about this is seeing this part of the story where the mathematics becomes so important to him. It will change his whole view of mathematics, in fact, because when he's working on the special theory, he's really rather skeptical about the use of mathematics. For example, when Minkowski introduces space-time and so forth, his initial reaction to that is, oh, well, this is just some nice formalism or something. There's nothing new to it. And he even maybe tries to refute it in a way, because he collaborates with Jakob Laub on a paper that tries to kind of knock it down, but he certainly didn't regard it as very important. By the time he gets to this stuff, he goes 180 degrees the other way. He's really completely taken up by the power of mathematical ideas to somehow focus physics where it's going. And John Norton, who's a great expert on Einstein's work in gravitation, has emphasized this. 1915 is really this kind of turning point when he has this breakthrough with the field equations and so forth. And from that point on, he becomes more and more convinced that the leading ideas, the ideas that physicists somehow have to grasp, come from mathematics and not from some empirical study. Of course, he's very much out of tune then with the rest of the physics community at that point. But
there's a question up there, please.
In about 1869, I think it was, the English mathematician Clifford made a statement that he said, basically, I hold that all physical phenomena are merely the vibrations of space. Yeah. And, you know, a remarkable statement. I think he was only about 23 when he said it. And as I said, it was 1869.
Yeah.
So he must have read Riemann, I would think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you have any...
I could comment a little bit more about that. In fact, the talk I originally started to prepare had Clifford and the British tradition in it. It got so complicated that I kind of decided I'd better try and tell a different story. But in fact, you're absolutely right that Clifford and the Brits think very geometrically anyway. There's a big, ether theories and all of that are quite geometric, or Maxwell in his work is, much of that is very inspired by geometry. So Maxwell, Tate, and Clifford, these people are really thinking very physically and geometrically at the same time. But Clifford, above all, receives this Riemannian impulse, and in particular, the very point you raised, the idea of something like matter waves or something, that you can capture matter and the phenomena of matter as some kind of curvature effects, localized curvature effects, that take place in a space-time. So he constructs a space-time, a four-dimensional space-time, which has global curvature that's nearly flat. It's an elliptic space. But it has this, the idea is really to try to get at matter that way. And it really, that was the most daring aspect of it. He has quite a lot of impact, it turns out, on particularly mathematicians in Britain. So though he dies young, he dies in 1879, but he's a truly important figure in the reception of Riemann's ideas. So thank you for bringing that up.
There's a question down here, please. Just wait 1 sec for the mic, please.
I'd like to point out that even Riemannian spaces are an idealization of reality, because we're realizing now that space itself might not be continuous. So we need it's an approximation of reality, like all geometry really is. Yeah. It's an idealization,
yeah,
because we make the assumption of continuity.
Yeah, yeah. If I may, just in defense of Riemann a little bit, in that same vein, there are two parts to his lecture. Of course, he never elaborates on it after that, so you know, it would be nice to know what he would have said afterward. But there are two parts to it, and one is really a kind of mathematical formalism. It's the theory of manifolds and so forth. And then the second part, he looks at possible applications, so to speak, of these concepts, including the possibility of discrete manifolds. So he is not by any means thinking, oh, it has to be a continuum or something like that. I mean, he has a whole framework for attacking, I suppose, a bunch of different physical problems in effect. So he has a very modern way of putting things. And one of the questions, of course, though, is what is the most apt way to talk about the geometry of global space? That's the most famous part of it, but he has these other things in there too. So Clifford, I think, was picking up on some of these other aspects of Riemann's ideas.
We have one last question. No, we don't.
Okay.
Oh, there's one down here.
Thanks for the lecture. I really enjoyed it. Do you think they'll ever be able to use mathematics to figure out dark matter and dark energy?
These are the questions that every historian dreads, you know what I'm saying? I mean, all of these things, what's going on today, I mean, it is amazing that there are connections to these things in the past, but everything is moving so fast today, and I mean, I really wouldn't want to speculate too much about where these things go. But it does interest me, of course, that much of modern physics is really rooted in certain important turns that take place and the role of mathematics in those. I mean, not so many years ago, historians of mathematics, I think, were so fixated on pure mathematics that they really missed the boat with a lot of what was going on. A figure like Gauss or Riemann and so forth, you cannot understand them that way, but I think by now people understand there's an interplay between mathematics and other disciplines. But I can't help you much with dark matter, I'm afraid.
Interesting how the historians never want to answer any of the questions about the future. We've had a few others like that, but David, thank you very much again for a stimulating lecture. Thank you again for joining us. Please join us on the fourth floor in the Black Hole Bistro, where David Rowe, in fact, will be if you want to continue the discussion informally. Thanks for coming. Good night.